I call the meeting of the Committee on Energy Finance and Policy to order. We have quorum, and I would like to start today with some introductions. We have some pages that we gave warning to that they were going to be introducing themselves, so we'd like to start with the pages. We thank you for your service, and give us your name and where you're from. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mike Thomas. I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. This is my 7-year house. Excited to be here.
Awesome, thank you. Why don't we start with Indy there, and we can work our way around. And staff and everyone through the way, just introduce yourselves as we go around. So if we miss you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Indiana Smallman. I'm the House GOP researcher for the committee.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rep. Paul Anderson, District 12A up from kind of west of St. Cloud to the South Dakota border. Good to be here.
Mr. Chairman, great to be back on energy. Dave Baker from Candiota County, small business guy, and looking forward to talking about a lot of important stuff. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Wiener. Represent 5B, central part of the state. First time on energy committee. I'm happy to be here.
Representative Tom Sexton, I'm from 19B, so Medford, Owatonna, and Waseca.
Representative Shane Mecklen, 27A, Becker Big Lake City, so seventh year on energy.
Representative Spencer Igo, third term and third term on energy. I'm just energized to be here. Thank you.
Representative Tom Murphy, 9B, Otter Tail and Douglas Counties.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ashley Eng. I'm the fiscal analyst from the Nonpartisan House Fiscal Analysis Department. My job is to track the budgetary decisions of the committee and request and present fiscal notes.
Hi, I'm Sharon Goblish. I'm the CLA for the Energy Committee and glad to be here. Thank you.
And just a reminder, if you have a bag or something sitting on one of your chairs, we're fairly full. If there is no seats, if you want to run up to, I think 316 is overflow. So if you're a member of the public listening or sitting out in the hall, feel free to go up there. We have it being telecast up there. But also, if you have a bag on a chair, please move it so someone can use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A.J. Broviak, I'll be the committee administrator for the GOP caucus here. Excited to be on energy.
Bob Eliff, House Research Department.
Chair and members, Mike Molzan, co-chair ACOM CA.
Hi, everybody. Representative Patty Akam. This is also my seventh year on energy. Looking forward to a great year. Thanks.
Hi, Larry Kraft. I represent St. Louis Park. It's my second term. My first term on energy, the last session I was on climate and energy.
Hi, I'm Katie Jones. I represent Minneapolis and downtown and southwest, and this is my first term. Excited to be here.
Hi, everybody. Athena Hollins. I represent District 66B. That's the northern neighborhoods of St. Paul. It's my third term and my third time on energy.
Representative Frazier, District 43A. Crystal and New Hope, the Hennepin County, first term on energy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anna Mahamud. I represent South Minneapolis, 62B, and this is my first term here.
Hello, Brad Tapke, State Representative for Shakopee, 54A.
Awesome. I think that's everybody. We got everyone that wants to introduce. We're not going to do public today, but thank you very much for coming. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Murphy, and we're going to move House File 9 before the committee.
Chair Swazinski moves that House File 9 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Chair Swazinski, it's your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. House File 9 really is a bill that's seeking to fix the DFL's agenda from last year. House File number 7, the blackout bill, as Republicans talked about it. This is really a lights-on bill as we're moving this bill forward. This sets an agenda, kind of a mini-omnibus bill, as we move an energy piece of legislation before this committee and ultimately, hopefully, to the House floor. This bill would make electric utilities better able to ensure reliability, and lower rates by providing exemptions to requirements to meet standards and prohibits demolishing fossil fuel plants. And if electric utilities aren't able to keep rates below 5% of the national average. And the reason for that is we already have that in statute that Minnesota's electrical rates need to keep that standard. As we're seeing a lot of growth potential when it comes to energy and energy consumption within Minnesota, we do not want to have arbitrary rules. And we've talked a lot about the ability to give off-ramps to the carbon-free by 2040 bill. And this bill seeks to seek opportunities that make it a lot easier for business within the state of Minnesota to maintain some very affordable electricity here in the state. And it also ends moratorium on construction of nuclear power plants and also qualifying larger hydroelectric power as an eligible energy technology under the renewable energy standard. That was an area that we were working on last year, wasn't able to get it across the goal, but to allow all hydroelectric across the board within our grid and within the power production areas that we do business with to count towards the reaching of our clean energy goals. And this bill also does some work that's already been done within the propane industry and allows a tax exemption on natural gas and electric derived from natural or from residential heat. And so there is that tax portion and so that tax relief. And so if we'd like to maybe maintain some of the conversations around the tax policy stuff in tax committee. I know we have an amendment for that in committee. And in the lieu of a fairly decent group of people that would like to speak on behalf or with concerns on the bill, Mr. Chair, I'd like to open it up for public testimony right off the bat and go from there and hear what the people have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see Representative Carroll stepped in the room. We introduced ourselves. If you'd like to do the same, that'd be great.
Got to get used to these things. So, Ned Carroll, representative, second term from Plymouth.
Thank you. We're going to move to testifiers now. Each testifier will have 90 seconds. It's important for us to move through this quickly. We have 29 testifiers. If your message has already been said, feel free to recuse yourself. And also, we want to pass this bill by 2:45, so that's the expectation for the proceedings today. So with that, we'll start. We have two testifiers that will join us by Zoom. We'll start out with Mr. Jacobson, followed by Mr. Romana, and then we'll move, and the first up on a seat will actually be Department of Commerce Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff, and also sitting next to him would be Peter Wagenius. As the second. So we'll start out now with Mark Jacobson on Zoom. It sounds like you're muted, sir.
Okay, there we go. Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Jacobson. I'm Stanford University, and I want to talk about three things. One is renewable energy plans we developed for Minnesota. We developed plans for all 50 states, and our energy plan for Minnesota just involves 100% clean renewable energy, wind, solar, and hydroelectric primarily. And these, just to give you a summary, these plans require 57% less energy than in a business as usual with fossil fuel case. Because of, for five reasons, the efficiency of electricity over combustion. So efficiency of electric vehicles over internal combustion engine vehicles, the efficiency of electric heat pumps over combustion heat pump heaters, the efficiency of electrified industry over combustion heat for industry, eliminating energy to mine, transport, and refine fossil fuels, and some end-use energy efficiency improvements. So we need 57% less energy if we electrify everything, provide that electricity with clean renewable energy. This is across all energy sectors, transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity. Because of the reduced energy requirements lower cost per unit energy of solar and wind in particular, we reduce annual energy cost by about $30 billion per year in Minnesota in 2050. That's by 64%. And we reduce health costs as well. There are about 600 people die from air pollution in Minnesota each year, and thousands more are ill. And that's about an $8 billion per year social cost that eliminated. We eliminated the climate cost to the world of Minnesota emissions of about $61 billion per year.
Mr. Jacobson, please wrap it up. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, the transition to renewable energy, it will save lives and reduce costs. With nuclear, there are seven main problems: planned operation times, high costs, nuclear weapons proliferation risk, core meltdown risk, waste and storage issues, carbon dioxide, water vapor and heat emissions, underground uranium mining, lung cancer risks. So, and small modular reactors, which do not exist commercially, have similar issues. And so there's the slides are available and they'll be detailed.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. We need to keep moving, so we'll move to our next testifier, Mr. Romana. You're welcome. Mr. Romana?
Thank you very much for letting me testify. My name is M.V. Ramana. I teach at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia at Vancouver. I'm just going to summarize my presentation, which I've already shared with the committee, by explaining that small modular reactors that Mark Jacobson mentioned will not help solve the problems of nuclear energy. As a source of electricity, nuclear energy is fading in importance globally. Its share of global electricity peaked in 1996 at 17.5%, and this fraction has been steadily declining, reaching barely over 9% in 2023. The most important reason for this decline is economics, and building new nuclear plants is extremely expensive, and Minnesota's electricity rates will only increase if new nuclear plants of any kind, small or large, are built. Small modular reactors will not help this because they lose out on economies of scale, and therefore they start off with an economic disadvantage. This has been the case with the Vogel, with the UAMPS project involving new scale reactors that will cost about 250% more than the initial per megawatt cost of the Vogel project, which was being the most expensive nuclear reactor built in the United States so far. Small modular reactors have also suffered construction delays, and they also have all of the other well-known problems associated with nuclear energy, in particular the absence of any demonstrated solutions to managing radioactive waste and the potential for catastrophic accidents. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Romana. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we have questions for some of the testifiers, when can we...
Great question. We'll plan on doing that after all the testifiers.
After all the testifiers?
And after the amendments. So we'll have our time after that to ask questions on all of that.
After the amendments?
I think it should just be on.
Okay, we'll do the questions prior to the amendments. Now we have Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff, Department of Commerce, and you have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Pete Wyckoff, and I'm Minnesota's Deputy Commissioner of Commerce for Energy. At the Commerce Division of Energy Resources, we work hard to help ensure that the energy system in Minnesota is fair, affordable, reliable, and increasingly clean. And we're working closely with the Public Utilities Commission on the implementation of Minnesota's 100% clean by 2040 electricity standard. HF9 seeks to elevate three sources of clean, firm, dispatchable technologies: nuclear, hydropower, and carbon capture and storage. The need for affordable, clean, firm is something Commerce is focused on as well, and there's likely room for agreement here. Though in every case, we would want further development of the legislative text to ensure environmental safeguards and the input of key communities, particularly the Prairie Island Indian community in the case of nuclear. What I want to focus on during my brief time allotted, however, is Section 2 of HF9. I think it contains a flawed premise. The underlying assumption seems to be that a move to clean energy will be a net financial strain for ratepayers, and that if rates are rising, delaying the move to clean is a solution. The opposite is true. At first blush, it may seem reasonable to apply the statewide target of 5% below average national electric rates or more to every utility covered by the 2040 standard. However, the state goal described is not meant to be applied on a utility-by-utility basis. Doing so would provide perverse incentives to seek or charge higher rates merely to avoid regulation. There are many safeguards already built into the 2040 law to protect ratepayers and reliability. Those off-ramps are being developed through a PUC docket process that began over a year ago and continues through this year. It would be premature to take further legislative action. Data from many sources, including modeling conducted as part of a storage study ordered by this body in 2023, show that, one, rates are going up or have been going up, in nominal terms at least, but that would be true whether or not we were keeping our current mix or moving to cleaner. Clean energy is not the driver of the rate increase. Instead, the increases have been driven mostly by volatile fossil fuel prices and the need to update aging infrastructure. Two, the move to clean will substantially lower electric rates in Minnesota from the late 2020s to at least the late 2030s. Delay in building out clean energy infrastructure will substantially harm ratepayers in the medium term. Low rates help attract businesses, but so does the move to clean itself, as many companies, including data centers, seek states that can offer clean electricity. Three, it is only as we approach 100% clean in 2040 that, under current policy, rates may rise again. That is because the clean firm technologies needed to clean the last fraction of the grid, like new nuclear, carbon capture and storage, green fuels like hydrogen, and long-duration energy storage, including potentially pumped hydro, are not yet low-cost like wind and solar. What this tells us is that we should take a tech-neutral approach with good environmental safeguards. This can be encouraged by sending a market signal to develop clean firm starting now. The hope is that some of the developing technologies will move down the cost curve considerably during the next 15 years.
Thank you.
If not, the 2040 law has off-ramps and the possibility of REC purchases to meet the standard. One final thought. Recent large grant awards to Minnesota rural electric co-ops, well over $1 billion in signed contracts with the federal government, will do a lot to offset the cost of the transition to clean for Minnesota co-op customers and move their electric system faster towards a low-cost, much lower fuel cost state. We intend to work to make sure that the current administration in Washington honors those and all signed contracts in the electricity space.
Thank you, Commissioner. Up next is Peter Wagenius, and then follow up, would you also join at the front, also is Kent Solem. On deck, please. Wagenius. Kent Solem. On deck is Aurora Votrum.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is this on? I'm here to support House File 9. The Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association believes that we need to have an all-of-the-above approach to discussing what viable forms of power that are reliable, affordable, and sustainable exist. Lifting the moratorium doesn't mean that a reactor of any size is going to be built. It means that we have meaningful dialogues over what it takes. For the munis, we're not likely to be the first ones building a reactor, but we would benefit from others in terms of investment opportunities, partnerships, and use of the resources they have that may be freed up to come down and help our members. We are very strongly in support of those provisions of the bill. We do have members that also would support or at least look at the hydro provisions. Again, for the same reason of an all-of-the-above dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you. And also, please state your name for the record when we're starting to do
that. Ken Solem with the Director of Government Relations for MMUA.
Thank you. Aurora, followed by Kirsan. Noelle Kirsan on deck, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aurora Votrin, and I'm the Legislative Director for 100%. 100% by 2040 became law with the broad support of almost 100 organizations, including faith leaders, labor unions, health professionals, scientists, youth, environmental advocates, community organizations, new Americans, indigenous leaders, rural organizations, educators, artists, and small business owners from every corner of the state. Our coalition had thousands of conversations with Minnesotans who were clear that they wanted our state to make the transition to clean electricity. We have concerns about the changes to the carbon-free and renewable energy standard proposed in this bill and feel strongly that any changes must go through a robust stakeholder engagement process. I appreciate and share the author's concern about reliability and affordability, but the provisions in this bill are antithetical to that balance, creating a redundant but also potentially devastating automatic delay to the carbon-free energy standard and a financial time bomb by banning the demolition of defunct and expensive fossil fuel infrastructure that no longer serves its purpose. The 100% law already provides off-ramps if a utility's transition would negatively impact reliability or affordability.
The PUC has the authority to delay the standard if necessary, which is a far more responsible solution than an automatic delay that could continue indefinitely. This automatic delay circumvents the PUC and IRP processes, which both play an important role in ensuring reliability and affordability. We know that renewable energy is quickly becoming the best and cheapest option, and we also know that as of 2018, 42% of existing coal power plants were operating at a loss.
Please close your comments. Thank you.
Assuming no policy changes, 72% of existing coal power plants will be operating as a loss as of 2040. Thanks for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Christian Kirsten, and then followed by Julia Frost Navon on deck, please.
First off, I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee for allowing me to speak today. My name is Noelle Sirison. I'm the political manager of MN350 and MN350 Action. I am here to testify in opposition to House File 9. The changes in this bill will completely undercut the 100% bill and leave many of the most vulnerable Minnesotans holding the bag for poor policy decisions that will put Minnesota behind in an inevitable move toward real clean energy solutions. While there are a lot of issues with this bill, I tend to focus primarily on carbon capture and the limitations on retired energy plant demolition. As far as carbon capture goes, CCS technology is often framed as a way to reduce emissions for the fossil fuel plants, but in reality, it has major downsides. The burden on environmental justice communities is a major one. Carbon capture projects often require extensive infrastructure, including pipelines to transport CO2 to underground storage sites. These pipelines disproportionately run through low-income and indigenous communities, increasing health and safety risk from potential leaks and ruptures. Inefficiency and corporate greenwashing are another big issue. The technology has failed at scale, with many projects either shutting down early or underperforming. Fossil fuel companies promote CCS to justify continued extraction and combustion rather than transitioning to cleaner energy. It also increases the demand for energy and pollution. Capturing and storing carbon requires additional energy, meaning power plants must burn even more fossil fuels to support CCS operations. This means...
Harrison, please wrap up your comments. Thank you.
And other health issues. This leads to higher rates of asthma, respiratory disease, and other health issues, particularly for frontline communities. And I will curb my second point around the demolition of fossil fuels, but I do have my written comments in your packet, so you can always refer to those. In conclusion, the policies in HS9 largely benefit corporations and utilities. We instead need a decentralized community-owned renewable energy, grid updates to the energy efficiency programs, and reduce cost to consumers, phasing out fossil fuels in a way that prioritizes workers and community-led transition.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you for thank you for your time.
Thank you, yep. Julia Frost Narbonne, followed by Daniel Trujano. Please state your name.
All right. My name is Julia Nurban, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We are an organization that represents hundreds of faith communities across Minnesota who have been advocating for climate action, equitable decarbonization, and indigenous rights for over two decades. And since 2019, MNIPL has engaged hundreds of people in promoting the 100% bill that was passed in 2023. We're concerned about several aspects of this bill, including the repeal of the nuclear moratorium, the blanket support for carbon capture, and unnecessary delays in meeting these commitments. But I want to speak to something that others may not speak about, which is the pieces of the bill that deal with hydroelectric power. When the legislature last adjusted what counted towards renewable energy, it was just 2 years ago. And that was a long series of conversations late at night with lots of people to figure that out. Hydroelectric was expanded to include large hydro facilities of 100 megawatts or more, but not new large hydro power facilities that would be operational after the date of the bill. Previously, only 100 megawatt projects or smaller counted. This fundamental change in the definition represents a battle between the power companies that want to count hydroelectric power and the impact in indigenous communities who want to protect their land and natural resources.
Mr. Vaughn, please wrap up your comments.
Yep. We want to stand with the indigenous communities of the north who are hoping to protect their land. We'd like to make sure that the hydropower is limited to new or to only older projects and not include new facilities. Thanks.
Thank you. Daniel Drana, followed by Kevin Pranis.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Daniel Trujano, a retired physician and a board member for Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, or HPHC. We are a network of hundreds of health professionals across Minnesota working to protect human health by promoting climate health. We oppose the delay in the timeline for compliance with the 100% carbon-free standard in Section 2 of the bill. The medical science is very clear. We are in a climate health emergency, and fossil fuel-based air pollution is responsible for 350,000 premature deaths in the U.S. each year. Minnesota's current 100% law will save lives and an estimated $1.2 billion in avoided health care costs between 2022 and 2040. HPHC also has concerns about the expansion of poorly regulated and risky carbon pipelines, which are in practice an integral part of the carbon capture and sequestration highlighted in Section 5. Concentrated carbon dioxide is a poisonous asphyxiant. We have already experienced CO2 pipeline ruptures, one leading to dozens of rural Mississippi residents needing to be hospitalized and several still suffering long-term health effects. The primary use of CO2 from these pipelines is for enhanced oil recovery, which will prolong the transition to clean energy while enriching oil companies through billions of dollars of taxpayer subsidies. HPHC urges committee members to reject House File 9,
Mr.
which adds unnecessary delays to 100% clean energy and encourages construction of dangerous carbon pipelines, which are false climate solutions aimed at enriching big oil companies. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Pranis, followed by Veta Kanitz.
Thank you. Kevin Pranis, on behalf of Liona, Minnesota, North Dakota, thank you, Chair, and our 14,000 members who construct and maintain building civil and energy infrastructure. We're here to support Minnesota's existing framework for reducing power sector carbon emissions while preserving the Public Utilities Commission's ability to prioritize affordability and reliability when improving utility plans and investments. We do understand the intent behind Sections 2 and 4, but are concerned that they could limit the ability of the Commission and utilities to pursue cost-effective carbon reductions. We do agree with Chair Swedzinski and the Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff that firm zero and low carbon resources such as carbon capture, large hydro, and nuclear have an important role to play in the energy transition, and support lifting the moratorium as long as we address the concerns of Prairie Island Indian and other communities that are affected. And I want to close by sharing a conversation with a representative of a global scale business who indicated that Minnesota's adoption of a carbon-free standard paired with energy permitting reform has made Minnesota an attractive place for them to make a very significant investment that will bring thousands of jobs and millions of dollars in economic activity to Minnesota. Our members would like to see that kind of progress continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pranis. Veta Kanitz, followed by Ian Hedberg on deck. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Swedzinski and members of the committee. I'm Veta Kanitz. I'm Chair Emeritus of the DFL Environmental Caucus and their legislative person. For the sake of time, I'm not going to repeat what I put in my submitted online comments, but I would like to share a couple important facts with you. I do question the need to add new nuclear to the grid in order to meet peak demand times. Nuclear power plants cannot be quickly ramped up to meet a need or scaled back down when there's abundant energy from wind and solar. There are other solutions, such as battery storage and virtual power plants, that we should be embracing to solve this problem. For example, the retired Sherco plant will have 710 megawatts of solar coupled with a 10-megawatt iron ore long-duration battery. We should also be scaling up virtual or distributed power plants to stabilize our grid during times of peak demand. Electric cars, bus batteries, electric appliances are some of the many ways this can be done. Virtual power plants already supply over 1,500 megawatts of electricity from 3.9 million homes in the United States. Solutions do exist. We should be embracing them, not lifting our 100% rule or extending timelines. We just need the political will to get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kanitz. Ian Hedberg, followed by Blake Johnson on deck.
Tester. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, last year Los Angeles caught on fire. Asheville, North Carolina, and Appalachia was wrecked by a freak hurricane that crossed mountains. The practice of homeowners insurance is about to collapse. Charging homeowners for the rebuilding of everything destroyed by global warming has become unaffordable. Now is the time to prioritize protecting our towns, cities, farms, businesses, and suburbs from global warming. We need to stop burning carbon compounds right now. HF9 will ruin us. Relying on fossil fuels to try to deliver energy in severe weather events is like using heroin to cure the pain of heroin withdrawal. It makes the problem worse until it becomes unmanageable. We assume in an emergency, supply chains will deliver a constant supply of fossil fuels, that oil fields won't be destroyed, that roads won't collapse, that pipelines won't leak. Fossil fuels are familiar. They are not safe. The only thing that makes them reliable is the hard work keeping them going in an emergency, the same work that can and does deliver stored energy from wind and solar reliably in an emergency. Renewable energy is cheaper than fossil fuels. I oppose HF9. Three provisions, 2, 4, and 5, create the perverse incentive to hike up rates for Minnesota citizens so that XL Energy can dodge regulations. The fact of the matter is we cannot afford any more delays in stopping global warming. Sooner or later, an extreme weather catastrophe is going to hit each of us where we live.
Thank you, Mr. Hedberg. Blake Johnson, followed by Erica Jones on deck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Blake Johnson. I'm the government relations representative for the Prairie Island Indian community. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before the committee today. My comments today will sound very similar to the comments I made when this bill was heard previously in this committee. The repeal of the nuclear moratorium is an issue incredibly important to our tribe, given the history of our tribe relative to the Prairie Island nuclear generating plant. The Prairie Island Indian community is a federally recognized tribe in Minnesota whose reservation is located on an island, Prairie Island, in the Mississippi River. Our reservation sits less than 700 yards from the plant and over 1,000 tons of nuclear waste generated from the plant. We are the closest community, native or non-native, in the nation to a nuclear plant and store nuclear waste. As you recall from my previous testimony, both the nuclear plant and the waste were sited next to the tribe without our consultation or consent. When the plant was constructed in the early 1970s, Prairie Island had just received electricity and running water a couple years before. Economic opportunity for tribal members was almost entirely non-existent. Members alive at that time, including my dad, slept in tents and slogged through the mud to the end of the reservation to catch the school bus. Suffice to say that the tribe at that time did not have the means or the wherewithal to engage with the PUC, lobby the legislature, or bring legal action. As a result, the plant was simply put next to us. Then in the mid-1990s, when it became clear that there was nowhere for the spent nuclear waste to go, the PUC and the legislature authorized the storage of spent fuel next to our tribe.
Mr. Johnson, could you please wrap up your comments?
Yes. I think from the Prairie Island Indian community standpoint, having to move forward and understand the history of the nuclear power next to our tribe is very important. A number of different issues have come up and things have taken place that have affected the understanding of where our tribe sits. As we look for the solution of how the state moves forward in energy and baseload energy, I would like to say at this time, Prairie Island cannot sit here to support the repeal of the nuclear moratorium contained in Section 3 of House File 9. That said, we appreciate the engagement and the productive discussions we've had with legislators over the years on this issue and are in active discussions on these issues internally amongst our tribal council and our community members.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, followed by Mike Rowland. Erica Jones, I'm sorry. Mike Rowland, followed by Michelle Benson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Rollin. I'm a member of ISAIAH. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 9. I'm here as a lifelong Minnesotan who has seen how our climate has drastically changed in my lifetime and as a father of two teenagers. I know I can't protect my kids from all the harms of the world, but with the hottest January ever in Minnesota, wildfire smoke choking us every summer, and American cities wiped off the map by fire and flood, it is getting increasingly hard to feel like they will have the future they deserve, that all of our children deserve. Excuse me. When the 100% clean energy standard passed in 2023, it gave our family hope, a hope born from action, from the thousands of Minnesotans across race, region, and sector who worked for years to create a bill that would protect our families and futures, and finally, and that our elected leaders were finally listening and acting at the scale we needed to address this crisis. The 100% bill does not address everything in the climate crisis, but it creates a baseline for which we can decarbonize transit, housing, and all sectors of our economy. House File 9 erodes that baseline. We took a big step forward. This is five steps backwards. A key piece in the 100% standard is ending emissions from the energy sector by 2040. House File 9 creates incentive for electric utilities to maintain high rates that would exempt them from complying with that standard, effectively extending the deadline to comply indefinitely. That delay means denying our freedom to breathe clean air. House File 9 also aims to create a new state policy prioritizing unproven and expensive industrial carbon capture and sequestration. I would much prefer a state policy instead to weatherize and electrify every home in Minnesota. That way, every Minnesotan, renter and homeowner alike, could lower utility bills, cleaner indoor air and outdoor air, and more resilient homes and communities. That would be a real solution for our families, not a giveaway to polluting industries. I ask you to oppose House File 9 and instead work to ensure that the 100% standard we passed is fully implemented so that everyone, no matter our race, income, or region, benefits from Minnesota's transition to clean energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland. Michelle Benson, followed by Jenny Glumack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Swedinsky, and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Benson. I'm Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on House File 9. The Chamber and our more than 6,300 members believe in the triple aim of affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy. Meeting all three parts of this goal is essential for Minnesota businesses to remain competitive regionally, nationally, and globally. Minnesota's business community has been stepping up with innovative ways to expand electric transportation, energy-efficient buildings, materials, tools, and technology, and expects a low-cost energy supply to support those investments. As Minnesota businesses, employers, create products and serve customers, energy is a major cost for many businesses in Minnesota. In the past two decades, commercial and industrial electric affordability has suffered. Minnesota's electric rates were once an attractive feature for business expansion or relocation with costs that were below the national average. Now, our commercial industrial rates are the 12th highest in the country. The reliability of energy is also critical for Minnesota's economy. Outages pose enormous safety risks to Minnesotans and create operational disruptions with significant economic impacts. House File 9 directly addresses the energy concerns of Minnesota innovators and employers by expanding carbon-free energy production in the form of hydroelectric power, studying carbon sequestration, lifting the prohibition on expanding nuclear power in Minnesota. I must note, I appreciate that the Prairie Island community is part of this conversation because they have been impacted by this policy in the past. We believe that the priorities outlined in House File 9 will reduce energy costs for Minnesotans, improve reliability, and respect the goal of cleaner energy for the benefit of Minnesota ratepayers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jennifer Glumack, and then followed by George Crocker on deck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's nice to see everyone here. My name is Jenny Glumack. I am the Director of Government Affairs at the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. MREA represents the 50 not-for-profit electric cooperatives who provide power to 1.7 million member owners throughout the state, and we cover 85% of Minnesota's geography. I'm here to testify on House File 9, specifically to the all-resources approach to this bill, and thank Chair Swedinsky for bringing it forward. Minnesota cooperatives are on track to meet the state's 2040 carbon-free standard, but with the rising energy demand, we continue to be concerned about reliability and affordability as we move forward. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC, has identified the MISO region, which includes Minnesota, as being at high risk of capacity shortfalls within the next decade. We believe Minnesota needs to embrace an all-resources approach and include all carbon-free and dispatchable resources and not incentivize one over the other. NERC's 2024 Long-Term Reliability Assessment highlights the urgent need for firm, reliable power sources like nuclear energy to maintain grid stability and meet increasing demand. We appreciate that this bill includes lifting the nuclear moratorium and any level of carbon capture. Nuclear is the only carbon-free resource that can provide 24-hour baseload power. As it stands today, Minnesota has one of the most aggressive carbon-free energy standards in the nation and has the only state a state with a complete ban on the nuclear moratorium. And we'd like to see that changed. As the committee moves forward with legislation this session, we would ask that you look at every policy through the lens of reliability and affordability. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crocker, followed by Annie Levinson-Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office. And I'm here to testify that the hydro provision in this bill makes as much sense as installing a turbine at Minnehaha Park. That and the attempt to repeal the nuclear moratorium illustrate the degree to which our society is functionally illiterate when it comes to energy management. And if you want to understand what I mean by that, get the book about power, read it, and learn. But the focus of my testimony is on recent data from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, that was not available 30 years ago when the nuclear moratorium was enacted. During these past 30 years, the first cancer latency periods have run their course, and now we have accelerating body counts due to exposure to routine radioactive releases in counties that host the oldest nuclear power plants. In Minnesota, that's Wright, Sherburne, and Goodhue counties, where every month, two or three people get killed by excessive cancer rates. You have a handout that goes into the details.
Mr. Crocker, could you wrap up your comments?
I would urge you to not enable serial killers and then pay them to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Annie Levinson-Falk, followed by Chelsea DeArmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. We're a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota's residential energy consumers. First, I want to say that I welcome the focus on affordability. We are seeing issues with energy affordability. And the data shows that people who've been struggling to pay their energy bills have been falling farther behind since 2020. I think it's probably a combination of factors, including the compounding effects of inflation generally, the cost of housing, and the high gas prices that we saw a couple of years ago. That has started to ease a little bit, but there's still a lot of past due energy bills in Minnesota. However, enforcing a mandate that rates for each class be 5% below the national average could actually end up increasing residential energy rates in order to reduce rates for other classes of customers. As a measure of affordability, I'd suggest that members look at the energy cost as a percent of income or the percent of households who are unable to pay their utility bills and the trends in utility arrearages and shutoffs. Additionally, halting decarbonization efforts won't resolve this issue. The Citizens Utility Board has scrutinized utilities rate increase requests, and what we see is that rate increases are being driven by other factors, including investor-owned utilities' return on equity, inflation, and a number of other things. We also recognize that climate change and air pollution have cost to Minnesotans, too, outside of electricity rates, and should be part of the consideration. Finally, I want to offer support for exempting residential energy services from sales tax. If the state budget allows for this, I think it could be really helpful for a lot of households. I would note that we're seeing some difficulties in the way the current heating fuel tax exemption works in practice, and the result is that a lot of qualified households are not actually getting the sales tax exemption that they qualify for. So it's complicated, especially for folks that heat with electric heat, and I'd be happy to follow up if folks want to dig more into that.
Thank you. Chelsea DeArmond, and followed by Alan Kleckner.
Thank you, Chair and members of the House Energy Committee. My name is Chelsea DeArmond, and I'm the St. Paul climate organizer for Unidos, Minnesota. I'm also a constituent of 44A. Unidos, Minnesota is a multiracial, multigenerational grassroots organization that builds power for Minnesota's working families. HF9 contradicts the intent of the 100% law by saying that if utilities raise electricity rates above a certain threshold, they should be permitted to continue burning fossil fuels. It suggests that this would be a cost-saving solution rather than the source of cost burdens that many Minnesotans are already struggling to afford. For example, increasingly extreme weather due to climate change is costing the state billions in damage to infrastructure, public health, crop failure, and lost productivity. The New York Times reported that Minnesota was the only state where homeowners insurance companies lost money in each of the past 5 years, and insured losses in Minnesota have quadrupled since 2014. Houses that are uninsurable are also not able to get financing. Minnesota working families are already bearing the costs of climate change, and allowing utility companies to burn more fossil fuel will only increase them. Coal and nuclear power are not only the most expensive ways to generate electricity, they also generate expensive pollution that causes generational harm to Minnesota communities. Carbon capture only adds burdensome costs with unproven benefits. The state has a duty to its citizens to chart a path to 100% clean renewable energy by 2040. Please vote no to HF9.
Thank you. Alan Kleckner, followed by Lindsay Potter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. My name is Alan Kleckner, and I'm the Chief Policy Officer at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to achieve equitable carbon-neutral economies by mid-century. We appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns regarding House File 9. Minnesota has a well-established track record of public policy support for affordable, clean energy. When Minnesota's first renewable energy standard was passed in 2007, there were concerns from some stakeholders about affordability and feasibility. In reality, Minnesota utilities successfully met compliance with the standard nearly 7 years early and without adverse impacts on electricity costs. Fresh Energy believes strongly that policymakers should work to ensure that electricity costs remain affordable and that clean energy is a vital tool for achieving this goal. Minnesota's utilities, energy stakeholders, and regulators have shown that they are clearly up to the task. The 100% law is a much more recent landmark piece of public policy, and it's important to remember that it is still quite new, passed in just 2023, barely 2 years ago. The law is still being implemented, and we have more than 5 years until the first compliance benchmark. The law was also designed flexibly, with reasonable off-ramps and compliance mechanisms. While Minnesota's energy landscape is dynamic and demand needs can and do change, the 100% law anticipated this in its design. Minnesota has developed a comprehensive energy strategy designed to foster innovation, create jobs, and position Minnesota as a leader in the clean energy economy. The 100% law is a critical component of this strategy and should not be subjected to unnecessary and complicated changes at this time. For these reasons, Fresh Energy opposes House File 9. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collector. Lindsay Potter, followed by Gene Comstock.
Hello, committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lindsay Potter, and I am here on behalf of the Coalition for a Nuclear-Free Mississippi River to oppose House File 9, several points in House File 9, but in particular, I will focus on the suggested repeal of the nuclear moratorium. New nuclear technology takes 12 to 20 years or more to build and can run up to 300% over budget. Endeavors to build either new conventional reactors or new small modular reactors have tanked due to cost overruns of tens of billions of dollars. In the last 15 years, billions have been passed down to ratepayers without a single bit of electricity generated due to failed new nuclear infrastructure projects. All of this despite the billions poured into subsidizing nuclear power at the federal level. There are other proven means of meeting baseload needs with true renewables. In fact, on page 155 of Xcel's current 2024 to 2040 integrated resource plan, now under consideration before Minnesota's Public Utilities Commission, the state's own modeling and compass software did not select a small modular reactor when given the option to select one as a future energy source for these reasons. The Department of Commerce filing on the same docket says, quote, analysis shows that the nuclear units largely reduce energy from wind and energy from solar, end quote, showing that even Xcel's current reactors will be displacing other renewables from the grid, much less adding new reactors. Furthermore, the 2022 tritium leak at Xcel's Monticello reactor contained 14 trillion picocuries of radioactive tritium that can cross the placenta and increase cancer risk.
Ms. Potter, please wrap up your comments.
Yes. 167 billion picocuries of this tritium made it into the Mississippi River, drinking water for 20 million people, according to Xcel's own data. Xcel has a proven track record of failed attempts to contain these issues with nuclear reactors and cannot be trusted to run new reactors. Building new nuclear infrastructure is not simply the cost of a reactor. It represents the cost of hundreds of thousands of years of waste handling and the possibility of untold costs in cleaning up an accident or a disaster. Signing Minnesotans up for nuclear power means saddling them
with
its toxic waste and the costs, effects on recreation and tourism, and environmental health hazards. Thank you.
Thank you. Would be Gene Comstock followed by Mike Hirabashi.
I'm getting my chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Jean Comstock, and I live in St. Paul. Anyone with a clear and true understanding of climate change celebrated in 2023 when the 100% clean energy electricity bill was passed. In one fell swoop, Minnesota became one of the national climate leaders. Another proud moment for me was in early 2022 when the St. Paul City Council unanimously voted to declare the city was in a climate emergency. Even now, the city is currently updating its climate action and resilience plan. This is what emergencies call for, a plan to get out of it and benchmarks along the way to see how well we're doing. The 100% clean electricity bill did this on many levels, perhaps most dramatically with its commitment to 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040. Unfortunately, House File 9 appears to try to negate or roll back much of this clean energy bill or electricity bill. And I've got the points here that other speakers have already talked about. I'd just like to say every one of the actions proposed has the potential to measurably move us behind where we are now with the climate crisis. This is Minnesota. We cannot and will not step away from this fight.
Thank you. Mr. Hirabashi, followed by Sarah Maradian.
Hi, I'm Mike Hirabashi, a window washer in St. Paul. We have seen overwhelming evidence that the climate crisis is here, from historic droughts, storms, forest fires, flooding, to increasingly unseasonable temperatures and extreme weather events. Yet large corporations and wealthy business interests use their money and lobbyists to push for bills like this that roll back existing climate laws instead of making progress. As a reminder to us all, it was Texas's lack of weatherization on their gas infrastructure, as well as Xcel's lack of upkeep on their peaker plant, that caused Xcel to buy up huge amounts of price-gouged natural gas. This heavily jacked up our rates and instigated Xcel to keep pushing for permanent price rates ever since. And wouldn't you know it, Texas just got hit with another winter with record low temperatures and snowfall. It looks like history is about to repeat itself in what increasingly feels like the new normal. Our reliance on the burning of a limited resource for energy production is a severe weakness that makes us vulnerable to regular price hikes and sticker shock. Clean, renewable energy is, very importantly, renewable and highly efficient. But let's be clear. Xcel is a for-profit company that has a mandate to maximize the profits of their shareholders and a state-sanctioned near monopoly on our energy. They're going to use every excuse to jack up our rates whenever they can, regardless of whether they need to. That's the reality. But one thing is clear. We don't need corporate exemptions to our climate goals. We need work put in to make sure our goals are met and that Minnesotans aren't abandoned in favor of lobbyists and corporate interests. Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Maradian, followed by Tina Clark.
Hello, my name is Sarah Maradian. I'm the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE. CURE strongly opposes the portions of House File 9 that would allow for all hydropower to count towards a utility's carbon-free compliance requirements, that would repeal the existing nuclear moratorium, and would establish an automatic 3-year grace period for utilities who do not achieve carbon-free standards. We're especially concerned with Section 5 about carbon capture for the reasons already stated by many today and is explained in more detail in my written testimony. But I do want to highlight the safety risks for you now. CO2 captured in Minnesota would likely be transported via high-pressure pipelines. No pipeline is without risks, but CO2 pipelines are uniquely dangerous. A CO2 pipeline rupture can freeze the surrounding area, create pressure waves that present internal hemorrhaging risks, and release quantities of CO2 that can asphyxiate those nearby. The federal agency charged with regulating the safety of CO2 pipelines has acknowledged how ill-prepared we are to handle CO2 accidents and even attempted to start a rulemaking process to promulgate more than a dozen essential safety updates. But given the upheaval occurring at the federal level, there is little chance of those rules being finalized anytime soon. In the meantime, Minnesota communities remain at risk if substandard pipelines are permitted or built before these rules are overhauled. In short, blind support for CCUS technology that cannot help us achieve our climate goals and that puts our communities at risk is not in the best interest of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Tina Clark, followed by Eric Meyer.
Hello, my name is Tina Clark. I have a public policy background in nuclear weapons policy and worked in Washington for many years on public interest issues, including climate issues since 1990, and most recently in Denmark for 4 years, helping their academics and labor unions and businesses all make a more efficient transition to 100% clean, safe, renewable energy. And I can assure you that the vast majority of that country, with their goal of 80% reductions among the well-informed and 70% officially below 1990 levels, put our goal to shame. We are doing the very basic minimum. Taxpayers, ratepayers, and residents are going to be very unhappy when they discover that promises for nuclear power and for carbon capture actually raise rates. I'm a part-time rental property owner. I have 3 properties that are 100% electric. They all are powered by solar with wind backup. They all have high-efficiency technologies. I make a lot of money. They're very durable, highly effective, cost-effective rental properties. I can't speak more highly to the benefits of making the transition for my own financial security and for that of my renters, who are very loyal and appreciative, and I never have a problem renting any of it. I find tremendous enthusiasm. For businesses, I think the way to move forward with the high-efficiency renewable energy technologies is going to save them a lot of money, and we need to help our businesses and our communities make the transition. We know that nuclear energy...
Ms. Clark, could you wrap up your comments, please?
Thank you. Adds cost to the grid. Every panel of solar and wind energy reduces the cost of the grids. And I just want to just mention the NuScale. The only attempt to add a small modular reactor in this country had a over $4 billion bankruptcy bill when it finally, $4 billion from the taxpayer. And as people find out that this is actually going to harm them economically, I think we will see tremendous resentment at elected officials and agencies if they aren't out on the front to prevent this kind of mistake. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Eric Meyer, and I see that Peter Wagenius walked in, so he'll be on deck. Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon. I'm Eric Meyer, founder and director of Generation Atomic. It's a Minnesota environmental nonprofit. While this bill addresses many aspects of our energy future, I'll focus solely on lifting the nuclear moratorium, which should be the most bipartisan provision before us today. And I believe deserves its own bill, but nonetheless, over the past few years, we've seen 6 other states pass bills to allow new nuclear. In the past few months, we've seen multiple shuttered plants announcing restarts. And in the past days, the formation of a 10-state coalition to accelerate advanced nuclear deployment. Decades ago, America excelled at building nuclear plants, and I believe we can and must do it again. You heard claims today that nuclear is too expensive, but these often lack nuance, ignoring system costs like transmission and storage. The data shows that states and countries with significant nuclear power typically have lower electricity costs while providing thousands of the highest paying jobs in the energy sector. You won't hear from opponents that at the Vogtle project in Georgia, a first-of-a-kind build, the second new reactor actually costs 30% less than the first. Costs drop with experience, and they've done the heavy lifting. We've also seen big cost reductions in solar components, which is great, but those happened in China, where more than 80% of U.S. solar panels ultimately come from. The money spent on nuclear goes to workers and businesses much closer to home. In my opinion, these are complex economic decisions that are best evaluated by the experts at utilities and the Public Utilities Commission, not by the legislature. And that's why we should look
please
at the moratorium
comments
to let them do that.
Thank you. Mr. Wagenius, followed by Steve Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wagenius, Legislative Director with Sierra Club. We oppose House File 5 and any other proposed rollbacks of the 100% clean electricity law. We don't have time to waste on false climate solutions that this legislation would invite. Journalists like Amy Westervelt have documented how polluting fossil fuel industries have taken their standard practices, such as using carbon dioxide to push more oil out of the ground, and rebranded it as carbon capture. As much as we oppose a categorical endorsement of industrial carbon capture, neither do we support a categorical rejection. Some forms of carbon capture deserve exploration. Minnesota could lead in green steel if we ask the right questions. But House File 5 doesn't ask any questions of big oil or big ag, who have increasingly joined forces to slow down the common threat to their profits, which is electric vehicles. Ethanol, in their quest for ever larger subsidies, developed a plan to partially capture carbon from their plants and ship it to North Dakota to be used for enhanced oil recovery. With this bill, we run the risk of supporting such industry plans whose primary goal is not to reduce emissions in the real world, but simply to reduce their CI scores on paper and secure federal subsidies through 45Q. With the cost of truly green technologies continuing to plummet, we can easily envision a future where we have declared independence from both ethanol and fossil fuels and saved money for Minnesotans in the process. But House File 5 is not a declaration of independence. It is a declaration of gullibility. It says Minnesotans will fall for any scheme from big oil, big ag, or any other polluter and not ask any questions. We ask legislators to oppose House File 5.
Thank you. Now we have our last testifier, Steve Morse. Not seeing Mr. Morse, we'll open it up now to questions of the testifiers from
or Mr. Chair, if you want to ask if there's any from the public, maybe.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify? Yes. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rachel Stuckey, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. We support a market-based all-of-the-above approach to energy for Minnesota and believe that this approach will be required to meet our state's objectives of a clean, affordable, and reliable energy system. MNCEF supports the transition to cleaner energy, and we've consistently opposed government mandates that interfere with allowing market forces to work. We believe setting deadlines while restricting technologies that are necessary to achieve decarbonization is harmful for meeting increasing demand while ensuring reliability and affordability, which should be our priorities. If the mandate proves unattainable without compromising these essential requirements, we should be willing to adjust as necessary. For decades, there has been broad consensus on the need to generate more electricity closer to home, and to the extent Minnesota has had bipartisan policy consensus on energy issues, it is centered upon cleaner, more reliable, and more locally generated energy. This aligns with the bill's support for baseload power sources while not limiting other types of energy, such as residential heating fuels, all of which complement wind, solar, storage, and other contributors to our energy mix. This bill represents a promising start toward an all-of-the-above Minnesota energy policy that prioritizes that clean and affordable power. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stuckey. Also, thank you to all the testifiers that are here today. Appreciate all of your comments. Mr. Jacobson and Mr. Romano had to leave, and so we will take questions on your behalf. if you have questions for them and make sure that we pass them on. Are there anyone that has questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have questions for the two of them, so but I'll just highlight a couple things that I wanted to confirm. By the way, I noted Professor Jacobson is a, you know, almost world-known authority on these issues. So I was, whoever got him to come testify, thank you. I think I noted him saying, as he had to go very quickly, that transitioning to 100% clean renewable energy would save us 57% on our overall energy requirements. And I think I also heard $30 billion of reduced direct costs per year and $70 billion of indirect societal costs. And so I was just hoping to verify those, because those are some serious numbers. And then the second person from the University of British Columbia, I forget his name.
That was M.V. Ramana.
Ramana, Mr. Yep. Ramana. I wanted to, he talked about small modular won't help. And I'm someone that's been interested in small modular, but it was interesting him talking about they're seeing small modular showing 250% of Vodal costs, the Georgia costs. So I wanted to verify that as well. So those are some of the things that that I was hoping to hear from them. Yeah, those are.
Representative Kraft, who we've forwarded them emails. Their emails to everyone, so if you have any follow-up with them, you're certainly welcome to do that as well. Thank you. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all the testifiers who came and testified for or on behalf of the bill today. A couple of things that were comments that were made that didn't sound quite right to me, and I was wondering if I could maybe ask nonpartisan to verify. I think there was a claim made that Minnesota has the most expensive energy or electric rates in the country, and I wanted to get a little feedback from nonpartisan in terms of the reality.
Thank you. Nonpartisan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, I'm looking at some data that was prepared by the U.S. Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration. From the Electric Power Monthly publication, which reports electricity prices in October 2024 for residential, commercial, industrial, and all sectors of customers and for all 50 states. And I can just report some of the data that they found. With respect to residential prices, Minnesota was 7.9% below the national average. With respect to commercial prices, Minnesota was 9.5% below national average. With respect to industrial prices, Minnesota was 10.5% above the national average. And when you throw them all together, for all customers, Minnesota was 6.8% below the national average.
Thank you, Ms. Eliff. Ms. Akam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Eliff. I appreciate that. And there was another claim that Minnesota was the only state that has a nuclear moratorium. Wondering if you have any information about if there are potential other states that also have a nuclear moratorium.
Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, currently there are 9 states altogether that have nuclear moratoria, Minnesota being one of them.
Thank you, Ms. Nakem.
One more question, if I may, and actually this is a question for the author of the bill. I think that as I was looking through materials, I don't see that there's a Senate author, and I find that just a little perplexing, given the Senate's been organized a little bit longer than the House has been, and just wanted to ask you a question about the path for this bill or the likelihood of any kind of a successful attempt if you're not exploring Senate authors.
Thank you, Representative. Chair Swazinski?
Yes, Chair Murphy, Chair Akam. We do have people that are talking about it to be dropping the bill shortly.
I look forward to that. Thank you, Mr.
Representative. Representative Kraft.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I do have some questions for the bill author, so if we're doing that now, I'll go ahead. By the way, I think I'm going to refer to this bill as the hurt, kill, and burden bill. in terms of hurting our economy, killing some more people, and burdening our kids. And to that end, I will ask about starting on the nuclear bit. So do you know what the status is, Chair Swedzinski, of the federal plan to store spent nuclear fuel? Or will this, if we were to lift the nuclear moratorium, would the storage have to be in Minnesota?
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kraft, you know, I believe there are two separate pronged approaches. I believe there is currently two different plans from the federal government. There's one of a private storage potential where they're offering the Department of Energy is moving forward with $25 million in kind of a welcoming portion. So say they're looking at communities that are looking to potentially develop this and welcome a storage facility. There's also some private development that would probably also work with the potential to store that on those facilities. And so, you know, obviously the big cat in the bag is Yucca Mountain when it came to the U.S. portion of how that would potentially be stored. I know Canada is looking at also some private held storage facilities for nuclear waste. And so there are some definite things moving in that particular area, and that is definitely part of the conversation. And obviously, lifting a moratorium doesn't automatically mean that, poof, next year there will be a nuclear facility in the state of Minnesota being developed. But what it does do when you have a moratorium is it really does shut down the potential for having the conversation.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Swedzinski. So, appreciate that. So are you saying that you're guaranteeing that if we were to lift this nuclear moratorium that the nuclear storage would not happen in Minnesota? And if not, would you consider inducing a proposal to store the casks in your district in an 8-minute walk from your house, because that's how far they are from the Perry Island community?
Representative Swedzinski.
Chair Murphy, Representative Kraft. You know, that is obviously an issue across the board when it comes to any generational, not the old not in my backyard conversation, whether it's nuclear cast storage next to Perry Island. And those conversations have been going on, Mr. Johnson and their board. You know, those are conversations that need to happen and continue to happen. You know, it's our goal, obviously, that the federal government does get their ducks in a row when it comes to the potential and how storage and how what the future of nuclear will look like. You know, Japan's really got some interesting things as well when it comes to they've been in the development of a refining capacity within Japan and what that might mean, whether it's going to potentially only process their own nuclear waste but potentially do international work as well. That is yet to be discovered. But I think we really need to be looking at the possibility of what that looks like. I believe there's also one in France, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, whether that's our legislature gathering our resources and going and visiting some of those sites and for the possibility of how Minnesota could be a leader when it comes to either the refinement or the storage. But that is definitely a national conversation that's happening. I think the last time nuclear waste has left our state was, I believe, in the 90s, 94. I think it either went to Illinois or Indiana, where they exported the nuclear waste. Nuclear power and nuclear waste does move around the country every single day, whether it's mostly Department of Defense nuclear products that are moving in day-to-day everywhere. And so really that conversation is a national one that we need to have. And so, Representative Kraft, I would recommend that we're both part of that conversation and what our future is when it comes to nuclear exploration, but also dealing with some of the byproducts of the industry. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Swedzinski, so good to hear that, but nuclear waste is moving from place to place. Is there any nuclear waste that is moving away from the Prairie Island community to somewhere else?
Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Murphy, and Representative Kraft. You know, it's my belief that nothing is moving, you know, and that's really does need to be part of a conversation as well. I've heard inklings that there are conversations about potentially moving things around or whatnot, and obviously we're at the beginning stages of a lot of that conversation and not potentially privy to every last one of them. But last time I checked, those casts are still there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Swedzinski. So I've been trying to figure out how to ask this question without sounding pithy, so forgive me if I do. My question is, who asked for this bill? Because I was at the 100% bill signing, and the president of Xcel spoke at it in favor of it. We just heard that our energy costs are actually below the national average. I pay attention to the PUC cases that come through, and I haven't seen any utilities file to modify or delay the 100% bill that we passed. And so I'm just wondering, who asked for this bill?
Chair Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question, Representative Hollins. You did a very good job of asking it in a non-pithy way. So good job. You did great. You know, I think that's, and this is a conversation we get to have. We are all legislators. We all have 40,000 folks that stand behind us in our districts that we represent. And, you know, when part of that conversation is, Mr. Eliff talked about, is, you know, the foundation of what is the average cost of electricity in Minnesota. And one of the areas that we did hear was from a business community's perspective that they pay 10% over the national average when it comes to that. And believe it or not, we all work for a business or government entity, and we all play a role in the performance of our electrical grid, the reliability of our electrical grid, and also the affordability of our electrical grid. And we live in an international market when it comes to the products we produce, the things that we do. And so this doesn't necessarily come say, Chris, would you carry this bill? But when visiting with constituents, they're very concerned about the viability of their job. When it comes to manufacturing, when it comes to reliability, when it comes to affordability and the safety of the grid. And this bill, I believe, moves us forward by allowing for multiple more off-ramps when it comes to energy generation in our state. And I think it potentially has the ability to address some of those concerns. And, you know, you look at from an international's perspective, and really what's going on internationally when it comes to our competition, when it comes to you know, the ability to deliver products at a more affordable cost, that is the conversation that we get to have. And I would rather be ahead of the curve than behind the curve. So when it comes to the nuclear moratorium, I think that's a good conversation that we get to have when it comes to reliability and baseload energy and what that looks like.
Representative Hollins, you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Swazinski. That's actually really helpful for me. I'm now trying to process how I'm supposed to tell my 40,000 plus constituents who are regular people who have to pay their regular electric bill that we are generating legislation to accommodate businesses when their electric bills are actually currently lower than the average, but the businesses are not. And I'm not asking you to solve this problem for me. I'm just trying to figure out, when I talk to the people in my district, which admittedly is mostly residential, I'm not hearing the complaints, right? Like, these are not the things I hear. And if I do hear it, I don't think that what is in this bill actually addresses their concerns directly. I will also say I'm a little disappointed that this bill is sort of everything clumped together as opposed to pieced out. I think you might have had a different conversation if it was not everything all together. But that's more of a comment than a question.
Thank you. Chair Swazinski, any follow-up?
I think that was a comment.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Swazinski, for allowing us to have this conversation. I first, actually, when you were talking about decarbonizing so industries, I'm actually really interested in that. And so anyone here in this committee or part of the legislature, I'd love to talk more about that. How do we decarbonize and keep rates low? Because I think we're all interested in having these clean air, clean water, and also affordable rates for our businesses. But a couple of questions that I have kind of related to businesses and markets. Just question, do you believe that public policy changes markets?
Chair Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, absolutely it does. It can create them. It can also diminish them. And so, you know, from a public policy standpoint, you know, when we're looking at politicians deciding market, you know, you do that by mandate. You do that by cultivating a firm, fertile field when it comes to business development and when it comes to objectivity, when it comes to the products in which they produce. So, you know, from a political standpoint, you know, there's multiple facets when it comes to the ability to create market And you know, oftentimes, you know, as a, I would be probably more considered a free market or a conservative when it comes to the government's role in that. And, you know, when you have companies like Xcel, you have different companies that are making their own dynamic decisions when it comes to how they want to acquire and acquisition their power supply or the supply of their raw materials for their business. Each business can make that decision as well. And each family can make that decision as well. So just as you have a surcharge on every single utility bill, you can make a mark on your Xcel bill and say, you know what, I would like to buy green energy, right? I would like to purchase hydroelectric. I would like to purchase solar. I would like to do whatever that might be. You have that ability to do that without government mandate. And so I think that's the fundamental difference when it comes to creating a market, creating subsidies, creating opportunity that is being argued that wouldn't exist on its own when there already is a scenario and also incentives to do that yourself. If you have, if you'd like a, you know, down the whole line of the acquisition, you look at the California Cars Initiative led by Governor Walz by turning over the acquisition of vehicles and what could potentially be sold and bought and delivered here in Minnesota and turning it over to bureaucrats. That's one way to do it, right? I don't necessarily agree that's the way it should be done. You know, if you, there are incentives out there, but I think it's the lack and the majority to lean on the iron fist of government to push things down the potential proverbial throat of the public, regardless. And so there are already market forces that would allow anyone in this room to purchase the style and the make and the model and the reliability and cost of the electricity that you would like today. You yourself, as an individual or business, could purchase the type of power that you want right now on your own. And we as legislators and public policy decision makers get to make that choice whether or not we want to force you to do that. And the idea and the argument that this bill will end coal is silly, because more coal will be burnt after the implementation of this bill than before it.
Representative Jones, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I'd like to respond. I loved how you were talking about how we now have the choice to select green energy. And I'm curious how many people actually know in this room know why we have that choice here in Minnesota. So I know we were talking previously about nuclear and about the Prairie Island. And that deal that was made in the early 90s, part of that deal was actually a mandate for Xcel to build a certain amount of wind. And of course, at the time, they were not excited about that. But once they built that wind, they were like, wow, this is cost effective. We want to do more of this. And so I think there is an opportunity to show here that yes, government is always going to have a hand when it comes to markets. And we need to, when we are doing that, we need to be thinking about the tragedy of the commons. And, you know, we all, you know, live in within our climate. We all have to drink our waters. We all have to breathe our air. And so it is government's responsibility to be that arbiter to protect everyday people, because I can't choose which pocket of air I'm going to breathe and which ones, you know, my neighbor is going to breathe. And that's why the government does have to create provide some guardrails around these markets and provide that fertile ground for new innovation. And I'm really excited about Minnesota because we, you know, we have the Energy Alley where we are investing in new companies and new technologies. And I think especially with the 100% bill, that is where we're going to see more innovation, because we're creating that structure just like we did in the early 90s with Xcel and the wind. We're going to see that too. And we want to be the leaders on clean energy here. So thank you.
I just want to clarify my comments. I said that more coal will be burnt after when the carbon-free 2040 bill is fully implemented. There will be more coal burnt, not this particular bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment and a question to all of us. I couldn't help but notice today during all the testimony we heard how many times we heard the phrase carbon-free electricity. And I have to ask us, is there really such a thing as carbon-free electricity? You know, it's as if we're imagining all the thousands of solar panels, many of which we've heard come from China, wind up in a farm field someplace in central Minnesota, ready to be installed on a bracketing to have free electricity, carbon-free electricity? Does it take into account the wind towers that come in on the Great Lakes system, unloaded at Duluth, hauled by huge semi-trucks down to maybe southwest Minnesota to be installed there, or the thousands of yards of cement used to make a base for these huge towers, or the thousands of tons of rebar used to make those bases? So, you know, when we talk about carbon-free electricity, there really is no such thing as carbon-free electricity when you take in the full life cycle of what it takes to produce the material to make the free electricity. And I'd just like to get that on the record that I think we're talking about today. A lot of us would agree that wind and solar have their place. I totally agree with that. But I think there's also a place for dependable baseload power that would come from natural gas, nuclear, coal, hydro, whatever, that we have in all of the above, because in this part of the world, this far north, running out of electricity in January or February on a cold day, it can be a life or death situation. And I think we need to keep that in mind and to really go for that all of the above energy policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Swazinski, do you have a follow-up to that? Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Murphy. Chair Swazinski, I'd like to talk about Section 4 a little bit, the retired fossil fuel electric generating plant demolition piece. You just talked about being free market conservative and without government mandates. And I, former mayor, and as we talk about these kinds of things, this section seems to be the exact opposite of that to me. So I'm new to the committee, and so I need to understand exactly what you're trying to get at with this. With this, our local utilities have very much turned away from fossil fuels and are going toward renewables, and have said that there are continuing fossil fuels is a bad business plan for them. And so they're headed this direction anyway, and so 2040 helps to get them to that. And so by having this political subdivision prohibited from issuing a permit, doesn't that take away business, local government autonomy in order to make their best decisions that they want to make? So how do you square that?
Well,
Chair Swazinski.
Chair Murphy, Representative Tapke, appreciate the question. You know, I think that's one of the unique things, and it was not necessarily initially right in the bill, but, you know, when we saw that the NERC report talked about the MISO grid right here in our local area was at potential high risk, and the primary driver was that because of the quickness in which the retirement of coal plants was occurring throughout the U.S., and especially here within the central United States, that's where that conversation is really starting. And, you know, as we have the conversation of demand and reliability and cost when it comes to energy generation, one of the big potentials is the huge expansion we're going to have when it comes to consumption, when it comes to energy. And whether that's data centers, whether it's AI and the rest, you look at the potential for real hardcore demand when it comes to what our grid needs, what the business community needs, and ultimately what our family needs. I'm concerned that we will cut our nose off to spite in order to reach. And so we get the understanding, and that's an area that I'd love to have a little bit deeper conversation as we move this bill forward today. And but our fear is that if our only goal in how does that interact, I'd love to have the question answered to say, you know, with the dynamic conversations we're having with data centers, the dynamic conversations we're having with AI and AI generation and the general load that is going to put on a grid, that if it's wise to destroy facilities that are already up, already going, already where they need to be, and have that. And so that's where that is born out of, and so that's why it exists.
Representative Tasky, do you have a follow-up at all? Representative Geigel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a brief comment, and thank you, Chair Swazinski, for the bill today. There were some comments made about how this bill is going to affect all of our districts and why we're doing it today. And I just want to bring everyone back to March 1st of last year. that I got a call at 7 in the morning from union representatives that 91 jobs in my community were being eliminated because of rising energy costs. So this is exactly why we are here today, because it is happening. I had 91 jobs in my community of Hibbing lost because of rising power, quoted in a news article that, quote, metal technologies leaders determined the need to close Northern Foundry for a number of reasons, including rate increases from Minnesota Power. It's happening. And it's happening in all of our districts, and that is why we're here today. So thank you, Chair Swazinski, and I hope we can pass the bill and move it forward today. Thank you.
Chair Swazinski, have any follow-up to that? Representative Kraft.
Thank you. A couple of comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Igo, I feel for your comment there. I remember when you raised this, and these are serious issues, and we should deal with those. I do want to point out that we had a couple of experts here that look at this stuff that are saying the increase in rates is primarily being driven by other things, by inflation, by fossil fuel prices, right? And Representative Anderson, I also want to, I appreciate your comments also. There is no free lunch. Solar panels, wind turbines, they have an environmental impact. That said, today, the impact of the, if you look at the life cycle of a solar panel versus coal, it is 20 times less carbon than coal. And the other thing that's really, and why renewables are so compelling from a cost perspective is there's no fuel cost. Right? And if you look, if you go back in history, if you look from World War II on, and Moody's did an analysis and said, every period of inflation since World War II was driven by fossil fuel prices. So by getting to renewables, which are cheaper, the other thing we'll be doing over time to our economy is insulating us from price swings caused by fossil fuel. By the way, we'll also be making our air healthier and having less people die from air pollution. So this direction that we, I think, well, I appreciate the bill. It's misguided, and it's going in the wrong direction from the intentions I believe you're going towards. Thank you.
Chair Swazinski, any follow-up? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Swazinski. I had another question about, so I believe, do off-ramps already exist in the current 100% law? Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm curious, is carbon capture already allowed in the existing law?
I believe there is some.
Yeah, Reverend Jones.
And so if those already exist, what is the need for this bill?
Chair Swazinski.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, in my conversations with stakeholders that there is a potential need for this. And so that's why it's there.
Representative Jones. Thank you. That wraps up our questions. And now we're going to move to the amendments. Is there an amendment? Would somebody be offering the A2 amendment? Representative Kraft.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for that. I'll move the A2 be to the committee.
Representative Kraft offers to bring forward the A2 amendment. Representative Kraft, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to get a roll call on this.
A roll call will be taken.
Okay. So this targets the discussion we've had around the nuclear facilities. And what it's just doing is recognizing the unique situation that we have in Minnesota with the Prairie Island community and with what the how close that waste is stored there. And so what this says is, look, that until unless an operating federally licensed facility for the timely and economical permanent disposal of radioactive waste generated by the proposed nuclear-powered electric generating plant exists. It says, let's be responsible. Before we would do anything like this, let's make sure there's a place for the waste that doesn't exacerbate the really challenging situations we have with waste right now in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Kraft. Is there any discussion? With that, Chairman will take the roll.
Chair Swidzinski?
No.
Vice Chair Murphy?
No.
Acomb?
Yes.
Kraft?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Carroll?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye.
Igo?
No.
Jones?
Aye.
Mahmoud?
Aye.
Beckland?
No.
Sexton?
No.
Weiner?
No.
Rep Baker?
No. Sorry.
Welcome to the committee.
Representative Baker. Baker. No. Okay.
There being seven no's and seven, eight no's and seven ayes, the amendment does not pass. Is there someone that will offer the A5 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A5.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Acom offers the A5.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would also like to request a roll call.
The roll call will be taken.
Thank you. And so all this amendment does is remove Section 2 from the bill, which is delaying the or modifying the meeting the standards for the 100% clean energy bill. And I think that we can look at our state history back in 2007 in a bipartisan way. We recognized and passed the Next Generation Energy Act because we recognized the importance of moving away from fossil fuels towards renewable and carbon-free energy. In 2023, we updated that law, that bill, by passing the 100% clean energy bill. And, you know, I will say that if for those of you who were on the committee then, it was a packed room such as this. The committee hearing took several days because of the engagement and the work that was done by the authors of the bill with all sectors of our economy and of the electric sector. So there was a lot of engagement. As you can see today, there's a lot of engagement, a lot of interest in this bill and what it's done. The 100% clean energy bill is moving Minnesota towards being a climate leader in the country. It's addressing the urgency and the need to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. I think we can look at the Trump suggested tariffs on our neighboring countries of Canada and Mexico. We have a trade deficit with Canada, especially in terms of energy, especially on fossil fuels. As I understand, Xcel Energy gets 90% of their natural gas from Canada. The impact on Minnesota Power was going to be significant because of the hydro and the nuclear and, I believe, the gas that they purchase from Canada. So as we are looking to Minnesota and the policies that we need to be making to ensure that we are self-reliant, that we are working towards a carbon-free future for all of us, certainly for, I think about it in terms of my children and hopefully one day grandchildren. We heard Commissioner Wyckoff talk about the importance of, or the significance of the volatility within our fossil fuel industry and the fact that we have guardrails already in place, as was brought up earlier by one of our committee members. So the delaying the standard is unnecessary and not smart. It's just not moving us in the direction that we need to do. So I would ask that we support the A5 amendment to remove Section 2 from the bill.
Thank you, Representative Acom. Any discussion? Renew that Representative Acom moves to pass the A5.
Mr. Chair, I would just,
Representative Taffney.
I, again, new to the committee, but I would just appreciate knowing what the chair what the bill author thinks about the amendments and understanding where the bill author is coming from on them. So I just would like to have that conversation about the amendment, if that's possible.
Representative Chair Swazinski.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Tapke. I appreciate your interest. You know, the AFAT, I would recommend first and foremost that the committee would vote no on this. You know, I think increasing the amount of off-ramps when it comes to the 2040 bill will serve families and businesses better, and that's why I would ask that you would vote no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Akam renews her motion to move the A5, and now we'll have a roll call. Sharon will take the roll.
Chair Swazinski?
No.
Vice Chair Murphy?
No.
Akam?
Yes.
Kraft?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Baker?
No.
Carroll?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Collins?
Yes.
Igoe?
No.
Jones?
Yes.
Mahmoud?
Aye.
Mecklund?
No.
Sexton?
No.
Wiener?
No.
There being 8 no's and 7 ayes, the motion does not pass. The amendment does not pass. The A7 amendment.
I'll be offering the A7, and I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call will be granted. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A7 is a very simple amendment that deletes Section 4, which is the section that Representative Tapke was just referring, placing mandates on local communities and organizations or utilities. So I think that as we want to make sure that we are allowing the conversations to be happening, as I understand in talking to Xcel and other utilities, that there is a long, already established process through the Public Utility Commission that looks at the long-term and short-term gains or pros and cons of shuttering a plant and removing a plant. And so I think, again, an unnecessary addition when there are already checks and balances in place to ensure that we are not prematurely ending generation. So I would encourage members vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Is there any discussion? Representative Jones.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to speak to the amendment from Representative Akam. In particular, I think about, when I think about power plants, you know, most people just think that they're out, far away from where people live, but there are actually a number of them that are existing within our city. And this is really valuable land that, you know, if a utility or a community no longer wants to have that in their community, they should be able to redevelop that land into housing, into businesses, into other things. And so allowing, communities to make that decision for themselves is pretty important.
Any further discussion? Chair Sinsky?
I can say thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Akam, thank you for the amendment. Thanks for the thoughtful process. Appreciate the giving it a heads up on amendments as well. This particular amendment, I get what you're saying when it comes to the potential for these to exist, and the concern is real on our behalf. We're very concerned about future needs when it comes to electrical generation, and we've seen what's gone on in Germany, where they're turning back towards plants that had been shuttered in the past to help fulfill some of their needs when it comes to the type of fuel that they use. And so we would also like to just keep this in the bill, and I'd appreciate a no vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Hollins.
I'm sorry. I know the bill author is supposed to speak last. I apologize. I was just catching up. So, if I may, Chair, I guess. So my question is I'm a little confused because if I know utilities like I do, they care about their bottom line, and I know Xcel cares deeply about its bottom line, and so I don't understand how we trust the market on one hand and we don't trust the market on the other hand. And so if Xcel thinks that they're going to need this coal plant, they are 100% going to keep that coal plant, and if they're going to need it to make a profit, they're going to hold on to it, right? So I don't understand why we would deny them the ability to make a choice, a business decision for their business. And I feel like it's kind of the antithesis of what your side of the aisle usually is advocating for. And so I'm trying to understand why we would insert ourselves into business of this sort, saying that they cannot demolish something that they have as an asset that they own that is no longer useful to them and, in fact, is probably costing them money to keep standing. It seems short-sighted to be inserting ourselves into those business decisions. And I also have a little bit of concern about what the ramifications for our ratepayers would be if we are telling them, no, you got to maintain this like old building that is crumbling and potentially dangerous and a liability because we might need it someday, theoretically. I know that was long and rambling. There was like five questions in there, but if you could address any of those, that'd be helpful.
Chair
Murphy, Representative Hollins. No, those are actual, and I think that's the conversation that this portion of the bill is trying to address, is that the uniqueness of the changing environment when it comes to new generation need, the new consumption need with AI and the data centers that are moving into the Midwest, whether that be in Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, or Minnesota, and what the role is. And if because we're an outlier, right? Minnesota is an outlier when it comes to the 2040 standards, when it comes to carbon emitting generation plants. Because we're an outlier, my concern is that if development of new business, which that's what all those are, potentially can outstrip the potential for models that were created under the 2040 plan and the way that those constructs are built, that we would have some pause on the deconstruction of them so that they will exist for potential. And so that is what this amendment's about, and that's what this portion of the bill is about, is really, should we pause and say, if we're going to be rushing to demolish these plants, will we really put ourselves at risk when it comes to the NARC report that already says that our MISO region is at risk? And so that's where that is born from. So thank you.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Section 4, it doesn't put a pause on waiting to have more discussions about it. It's an all-out prohibition on permits. So what you just said is not what this does. Am I inaccurate in that?
Chair Swazinski.
Chair Murphy. Sorry if I gave you a suppose, but it does actually stop the demolition, so if that helps.
Representative Tapke?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, because this is because what you just said was it was a pause to have more conversations and to do it, and that's just not what this is. And I'm still surprised that this is in here, so I very much support the amendment here, even though I'm a non-voting member, because this is the exact opposite of what your argument is for getting rid of the moratorium on discussing nuclear. These are two diametrically opposed things within the same bill, and I think that this would cleaning this up would help to make sure that this piece and the businesses and that utilities have the options that they need for going where they want and what they do. So I very much support the amendment here today.
Thank you. We're going to vote on the amendment, and then we're going to recess until 5 o'clock in G23. And so we'll take the roll. Was it a roll call on this one?
It was.
So Representative Akin renews her motion to move the A7 amendment, and now we'll take the roll.
Chair Swidzinski?
No.
Vice Chair Murphy?
No.
Acorn?
Yes.
Kraft?
Aye.
Anderson?
No.
Baker?
No.
Carroll?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Randall?
No.
Jones?
Aye.
Mahmoud?
Aye.
Becklund?
No.
Sexton?
No.
Wiener?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 8 noes, the amendment does not pass. The recess then will be a call of the chair, be at 5 o'clock p.m. in room G23.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be offering the
A8. Representative Akin is offering the A8. Would you proceed with the amendment?
Yes. Let's see. I am on here. And I would like to request a roll call.
Roll call is granted.
Great. And so the A8 is a very simple, I think it could be considered a friendly amendment.
That's my line.
That was actually, this goes back to Dave Baker days, when he used to be on the committee before. So I'm trending my Dave Baker here. This is a friendly amendment. It's looking at Section 5 of the bill, talking about carbon capture and carbon sequestration. And it's deleting that section for a couple of different reasons. The first is that it is, Chair Swazinski recognized earlier, both carbon capture and sequestration are permitted within the current structure of the 100% clean energy bill. So this is duplicative and unnecessary. And if we're going to start listing technologies, then we should be thorough and list all the technologies. I think that we can all agree that there's a lot of innovation going on in this sector, in the energy sector right now. I think carbon capture and sequestration is certainly one of them. Battery storage is another. There's low temperature geothermal. There's a lot of work being done around things like small modular nuclear. And so being technology neutral has huge advantages for allowing flexibility and innovation. And so for those reasons, I would encourage people to support the friendly amendment, to be seen as friendly, and vote to remove that section of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Is there any other further discussion from members? Go ahead. Representative Baker.
Thank you for this. I don't disagree. I think it's actually, I'm asking myself again, new back on the committee. I wasn't here for the last 2 years when all of this went through, so I'm gonna be asking, I'm gonna be playing a lot of catch up. But I'm just, I guess I'm kind of surprised, Representative Akam, that you'd want to remove something to me that makes so much sense to say, why would we take away this good idea or this part of the bill that the author wants to bring forward is to make sure that we are deploying every bit of technology that we can to make sure that our air is as clean as it can be. I mean, again, I think this is a great part of the bill, Section 5. So I would wholeheartedly ask the committee to not support the amendment, because I think it's exactly what we're looking for. I think this is what I'm understanding is we're trying to get to is leave everything on the table, all options. If there's a way to develop and deploy the carbon capture here, let's make sure it's part of the bill. So I appreciate the author bringing this forward. So thank you very much, and I will not support the amendment.
Everybody go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I'd speak to this because this is language I've been working on for a while, so it's not friendly to me. But, you know, I think it's worth saying that when we passed 2040, 2040 was making a policy of the state to limit carbon emissions and get to zero by 2040. So if we made a state policy to get to zero emissions, we should have added language like this to help us get to zero by 2040, and I applaud Chair Swazinski for adding this to his bill because he's trying to get at that while opening up the toolbox to give Minnesota businesses and Minnesota utilities every available opportunity to get to that point of zero while keeping the ratepayer in mind and keeping things affordable and reliable. So I will be voting no on the amendment. I encourage the committee to do the same.
Any further discussion? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just point out that carbon capture and sequestration is allowed as part of 2040. It can be done today. So what this seems to do is to say, to put a thumb on the scale, bias it towards that. This, I mean, it can be done today. So I don't think it's, I really agree with Representative Akam that we shouldn't put our thumbs on the scale here.
Any further discussion?
We're good. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. We'll take the roll. Our CLL will take the roll.
Chair Swazinski.
No.
Vice Chair Murphy.
No.
Akam.
Yes.
Kraft. Yes.
Anderson.
No.
Baker.
No.
Carroll.
Aye.
Frazier.
Aye.
Collins.
Aye.
No.
Jones.
Yes.
Mahmoud.
Aye.
Beckland.
No.
Sexton.
No.
Weiner.
No.
With seven ayes and eight noes, the amendment does not pass. Do we have an author for the A9 amendment? Representative Kraft.
I move the A9.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is to remove the sales tax exemption, and I want to talk about this a little bit. What's proposed here would cost the state, pretty close to $100 million a year. And I understand the concern, and especially for certain folks, of making sure that energy burden is lower. That said, if we want to spend, now, $100 million bucks in the current time, we have to work to figure out where that would come from. But if we want to spend that kind of money on this, let's make it much more effective. I will be bringing a bill on the low-income heating assistance program, which has been a program that we've done in Minnesota for 40 years, that targets the folks that need it the most, that, based on energy burden. We could spend this kind of money on that program. We could extend it to the summer months where, as with our warming climate, increasingly people are having issues with supporting their working on their cooling issues. We heard from Ms. Annie Levinson Falk, that are folks that are behind on their bills, from what's happened in COVID times. So I would love, I think this is not the way to do this kind of thing, that if we're gonna do it, let's focus on that bill. I would love to work with Chair Swedzinski on it. The other thing I would say is that by targeting this towards LIHEAP, to folks that really have the need for it, we'd actually be more effective on supporting economy in Minnesota too, because it's more likely that those folks are going to be spending all of that money and recirculating it back into the economy. So for that reason, I'd ask for a roll call.
Granted.
And I would, though I really appreciate the aim of this, I would say we can do a much better job at focusing this money where it's needed. So I'd ask you to accept this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Is there any further discussion on the Kraft A9 amendment? Chair Swedzinski.
Thank you, Chair Murphy and Representative Kraft. I would ask members to vote no. I think this is a primary example of we need to give relief to those that are actually paying the dollars. And so this would give relief to business owners, families across the board, not choosing winners or losers, but just, as the cost of energy, we've seen through this obviously more of a tax-related discussion that we can have here in committee. But, you look at the tax incident studies, that whether it's tax on a corporation, tax on a utility, the tax incident studies talk that 95% of those costs get passed on to you and me, regular people. The cost of doing business is more expensive. We learned earlier that, we're 10% over the national average when it comes to business and business owners. And so, focusing that so that we can retain jobs, retain our competitive edge and grow our competitive edge over our neighbors across state borders, national borders, and across the sea. And so with that, I would ask members to vote no.
Thanks, Chair Swedzinski. Kraft,
for all the reasons that I said, please vote yes.
Representative Kraft renews the motion to move the A9 amendment. So now Sharon will take the roll.
Chair Swedzinski?
No.
Vice Chair Murphy?
No.
Acomb?
Yes.
Kraft?
Yes.
Anderson?
No.
Baker?
No.
Carroll?
Aye.
Frazier?
Aye.
Hollins?
Aye.
Igo?
No.
Yes.
Mahmoud.
Aye.
Mecklen.
No.
Sexton.
No.
Weiner.
No.
With seven ayes and eight noes, the A9 amendment does not pass. Now we'll have discussion on the bill. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I love being back in energy. I want to thank the author, the chair of this committee, to
bring a lot of things in a very important bill and did it quickly. You did it on the first day you were in session, basically, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. It's a lot here, I get it, and we're going to have a lot more conversations about these kind of ideas as we go forward, because I think what this bill does is it leaves all options on the table. It doesn't say what to get, but if we're going to have a chance to even consider nuclear, we have to address the nuclear waste discussion. We have to get to that point, but we can't even start talking about it unless we know that it's part of our language of what we can talk about today. So again, there's a lot to this bill. It's a lot encompassing, but it does put us in the right direction to make sure that all of our options on the table for all companies, whether you're small or big or the big IOUs, it doesn't matter. It's the ability that we can use big hydro, whatever it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for really thinking this through and giving us a lot more tools to work with so that we have a chance of meeting our 2040 goal. Thank you.
Representative Akin. Akin, sorry.
No, you're good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to request a roll call on the voting of the withdrawal bill first. And then I would just say, I think that when we talk about ensuring that we have affordable rates, I think that that's a really important place that we all can agree on. I think that this bill and the efforts by this bill are not moving in that direction. When we talk about the impact on ratepayers in Georgia for the nuclear plant built there and the $500 additional a year just for that in rates, just for the nuclear plant, that's not affordable in Minnesotans' minds, in my mind. And so we, I think, recognize that there are, you know, there's volatility in the fossil fuel market. We saw what, oh.
You couldn't hear me. Okay. Oh. See, I project. Thanks, AJ. Sorry. It's this the whole senating thing. I'm not used to the Senate way of doing things. Affordability is important, and I do think we need to focus there. I think that some of the efforts in this bill are actually looking to limit innovation at a time when we need innovation even more. I think putting the thumb on the scale for carbon capture or sequestration, that to the, for those to be the only technologies being called out, I think is a disservice to Minnesota and the energy sector as a whole. I think the fact that we are in this bill looking to raise taxes at a time when our budgetary situation does not allow that, I think is downright irresponsible. I think that as we sit in a very close margins in our respective caucuses, and we know nothing can be passed off the House floor without bipartisan support, and there was zero acknowledgement or attempts to try and earn that today, is concerning. And I think as we look for this bill to go on to the tax committee, I think there'll be a good, robust discussion. But I think we all need to get back to the place where our reality is today. And our reality is we need bipartisan work if we're going to pass anything. And we can have statement bills, and we can have things that, you know, we need to carry forward for advocates. And in, at the end of the day, we need to be working together. And so I appreciate that, you know, we got started on day one on a really big bill when we have a lot of new members on both sides of the aisle. There's a lot of information that we all need to be working on to level set and see the path forward. And maybe we have a hearing on small modular nuclear so that we can learn together about what some of the issues are. So I think that while I understand the rush for getting things passed and moving, I want to remind people we need to be working bipartisanly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Akin. Are there any other comments on the bill? Chair Swazinski.
Yes, thank you, Chair Murphy. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 9 before the Energy Committee. Just to get back during the last time we were together earlier today, the question was asked about the Senate author, and it's just more of a paperwork issue between we had reintroduced it, and with the reintroduction, the new bill and the Senate author, who is Senator Matthews, have just not behind the computer wall or whatever been joined together. So that's all it is. So we appreciate that. Appreciate your support, and I'd ask for a green vote tonight. Thank you.
Chair Swazinski renews the motion that House File 9 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Sharon will take the roll.
Chair Swazinski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Aye.
Acom.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Anderson.
Anderson,
aye. Baker.
Yes.
Carroll.
No.
Frazier.
No.
No.
I go aye.
Jones.
No.
Mahmood.
No.
Meckland.
Aye.
Sexton.
Yes.
Weiner.
With 8 ayes and 7 noes, the House File 9 will move on to the Committee on Taxes and is passed. I'd like to thank Chair for allowing me to have the gavel today. It was my first time at the gavel, so I apologize in advance for anything there. Thank you. And we'll be meeting this coming Thursday, February the 13th at 1 o'clock to hear Representative Mecklen's bill on data centers. So this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.